Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, 6th chapter, verses 8 to 53. Verse 8. Sa itamari shasaranna jastitai, savan vitapiti visa pajeshai, yayasadishinyan nilayam puradisha, kailasamadri pavaram hiyam bhava. After thus instructing all the demigods, the pitas, and the lords of the living entities, Lord Brahma took them with him and left for the abode of Lord Shiva, known as Kailash Hill. So Daksha made a big mistake by neglecting to offer Lord Shiva his share of the sacrifice and by allowing his daughter to commit suicide in the sacrificial arena. And as a result, not only was a sacrifice destroyed by Lord Shiva's followers, but Daksha himself lost his life. So the survivors of the sacrifice then went to Lord Brahma and took shelter of him. They say, what to do? What can we do now? He is the head of the universe. So Virajan Prabhu made a nice comment here. He said, generally, in our life, we proceed in full confidence, knowing exactly what is going on. But when some calamity happens in our life, then we start questioning, oh, what to do? What is my position? What has gone wrong? Who has done this? Why is this happening to me? So this is, now they are questioning. They're just trying to do a nice sacrifice, so what did they do wrong? And obviously, what they did wrong was to offend the greatest Vaishnava, Lord Shiva. So therefore, Lord Brahma says that you should go and apologize to Lord Shiva. So here in the purport, we'll read the whole purport, which is one sentence. The abode of Lord Shiva, which is known as Kailash, is described in the 14 verses which follow. Has anybody visited Kailash? Or is it possible? Oh, Sankirtan does. Really? One devotee. He walked 3 days from Nepal village. Close to Kailash.
3 days before, then one has to walk the last 3 days.
3 days you have to walk.
One can drive. One can even have, I see it sounded like one can have cheap from that place.
Okay. By public transport. Then you have to walk. But did he make it up to the? It's forbidden. Yeah, it's forbidden to go. Okay. Yes.
There is a trekking route there, but you have to pay something like 2 lakhs, and you have to undergo some severe testing, medical testing.
Okay. If you want to go to Kailash, you can trek there. You have to pay 2 lakhs rupees, and you have to. Very severe, like you're going to be an astronaut. You want to go to Kailash, Brajabihari Prabhu? No. It only costs 2 lakhs. Okay, Madan Gopal? He went there. How did he go? He took it with a group, of course. Very fit people. Right. Oh, so they circumambulated it. A slide presentation. I wish we had it here now. Would have been nice. Okay, so we're just going to have to imagine it from the description here. Now, of course, I don't know if he saw this part of Kailash. Huh? There's nothing to see. It's not what you see. You saw a movie. Yes, just like the moon, there's nothing there, but actually there's so much. Nothing to see. Right. So why go there? Why bother Lord Shiva? So anyway, yes, he will make it so we think there's nothing to see. No, he's there, but anyway, okay, let's go on with the verses. So we'll see what it really looks like, Kailash. From verses 9, we'll read practically straight through to 32. The abode known as Kailash is full of different herbs and vegetables, and it is sanctified by Vedic hymns and mystic yoga practice. Thus, the residents of that abode are demigods by birth and have all mystic powers. So, you have to be quite qualified to live in Kailash. Besides them, there are other human beings who are known as Kinnaras and Gandharvas. So actually, these, quote, human beings are demigods also. Gandharvas are not ordinary human beings. And are accompanied by their beautiful wives who are known as Apsaras, or angels. Kailash is full of mountains, filled with all kinds of valuable jewels and minerals, and surrounded by all varieties of valuable trees and plants. The top of the hill is nicely decorated by various types of deer. There are many waterfalls, and in the mountains there are many beautiful caves in which the very beautiful wives of the mystics are found. So I think they didn't see Kailash, the real Kailash. On Kailash Hill, there is always the rhythmical sound of the peacock's sweet vibrations and the bees humming. Cuckoos are always singing, and other birds whisper amongst themselves. There are tall trees with straight branches that appear to call the sweet birds. And when herds of elephants pass through the hills, it appears that the Kailash Hill moves with them. When the waterfalls resound, it appears that Kailash Hill does also. Whole of Kailash Hill is decorated with various kinds of trees, of which the following names may be mentioned. Mandara, Parijat, Sarala, Tamal, Tala, Kovidara, Asana, Arjuna, Amrajati, Kadamba, Duli Kadamba, Naga, Punaga, Champaka, Patala, Ashok, Bakula, Kunda, and Kurubaka. The entire hill is decorated with such trees, which produce flowers of fragrant aromas. There are other trees which also decorate the hill, such as the golden lotus flower, the cinnamon tree, Malati, Kubja, Malika, and Madhavi. Kailash Hill is also decorated with such trees as Katta, jackfruit, Jolara, Banyan, Plaksha, Nyagrota, and trees producing Asafoetida. Also, there are trees of betel nut and Bhujapatra, as well as Rajapuga, blackberries, and similar other trees. There are mango trees, Priyala, Madhuka, Inguda. Besides this, there are other trees like thin bamboos, kichaka, and varieties of other bamboo trees, all decorating the tract of Kailash Hill. There are different kinds of lotus flowers, such as Kumuda, Utpala, and Shataputra. The forest appears to be a decorated garden, and the small lakes are full of various kinds of birds who whisper very sweetly. There are many kinds of other animals also, like deer, monkeys, boars, lions, rickshaws, shayakas, forest cows, forest asses, tigers, small deer, buffalo, and many other animals who are fully enjoying their lives. There are varieties of deer such as Karnantra, Ekapada, Shvasa, Vrika, and Kasturi, the deer which bears musk. Besides the deer, there are many banana trees which decorate the small hillside lakes very nicely. There is a small lake called Alakananda in which Sati used to take her bath, and that lake is especially auspicious. All the demigods, after seeing the specific beauty of Kailash Hill, were struck with wonder at the great opulence to be found there. So remember when Daksha was criticizing Lord Shiva, he was saying that, oh, you're so poor, I gave my daughter to you, but you're just like a bum with no money. So here, this argument is being defeated by the opulence of Kailash. And Sati herself said that we can exhibit our opulences simply by desiring to do so. So this is the opulence, and the demigods are amazed at the opulence. Of course, the demigods themselves have very high standard of living. But when they came to Kailash, even they were amazed at the opulence of Kailash. Verse 23. Thus, the demigods saw the wonderfully beautiful region known as Alaka, in the forest known as Sugandhika, which means full of fragrance. The forest is known as Sugandhika because of its abundance of lotus flowers. They also saw the two rivers named Nanda and Alakananda. These two rivers are sanctified by the dust of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda. 25. My dear Kshata Vidura, celestial damsels come down to those rivers in their airplanes with their husbands. And after sexual enjoyment, they enter the water and enjoy sprinkling their husbands with water. So here in the purport, there is a Sanskrit word which Srila Prabhupada, it's not in the Sanskrit here, but Prabhupada brings up this word, and the word is Tirthapad. And he explains the meaning of Tirthapad in the last paragraph. So what is the meaning of Tirthapad as in reference to the Supreme Lord? Srila Prabhupada explains. What is Tirtha? Yeah. Tirtha, okay. Oh, it's in the previous shloka. Okay, so there it is. So Prabhupada's picking up Tirthapad from verse 24. Tirthapad Parambhoja. So sanctified by the lotus feet of Govinda. So why are the Lord's feet called Tirthapad? So now we know the meaning, but why? Why are they so sacred? What do we know about Krishna's lotus feet? We heard in the last third canto something about devotees take shelter there, and that's why Krishna's lotus feet are so pure. Because here it says they're called Tirthapad because under their protection there are hundreds and thousands of saintly persons who sanctify the sacred places of pilgrimage. So the devotees, they're sanctifying the holy places. So therefore, Krishna's lotus feet are called Tirthapad because these devotees are always at Krishna's lotus feet. Tirthapad, yes. No need to go to holy place. Yes. Tirtha Bhuta Swayam Vibho. Tirthi Kurvanti Tirthani. So wherever, you don't have to go to a holy place. You just become a devotee and make your own holy place. Or you find one. So find a devotee who can make every place holy, like Srila Prabhupada. So the meaning of Tirthapad. At the end of the purport, Prabhupada says, in other words, such a pure devotee who is engaged 100% in the service of the Lord can remain anywhere in the universe, and that part of the universe immediately becomes a sacred place where he can peacefully render service to the Lord as the Lord desires. So Srila Prabhupada, he said that Vrindavan is actually not a geographical location. It's in the heart of the devotee. So wherever the devotee goes, that is the Vrindavan. That is where Vrindavan is. You may be living just like the devotees, they met Srila Prabhupada in New York and Boston and different places. And for them, that was Vrindavan. He created Vrindavan in all the places he went. So this is what is being said here. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, there is a nice quote. Does anybody know about that quote about Vrindavan? Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Nityananda misled him. After Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, then he asked Nityananda, where are you taking me? He says, I'm taking you to Vrindavan. So then he said, just see, here's the river Jamuna. Actually, it was the Ganga. So then Advaita Prabhu came there, and he said, oh, I am so happy to see you. Lord Chaitanya said, what are you doing in Vrindavan? And so Advaita said, oh, it's my great fortune you have come to the bank of the Ganga. So then he let out the secret. And he said, but anyway, wherever you are, that is Vrindavan. He said to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Lord Chaitanya said, Nityananda has cheated me. He's brought me to the Ganga instead of the Jamuna. He said it was Jamuna. And Advaita said, no, no, this part of Ganga, this is where the Jamuna flows. So it's actually Jamuna. Because in Mayapur, you have one bank is Jamuna, one bank is Ganga. Because they join in Allahabad and then they come to Mayapur. So therefore, he was actually at the Jamuna. But anyway, the point is that wherever the devotee is, that is Vrindavan. So we'll read on. Verse 26. Right. Yes. Okay. So his question is, of course, we understand wherever the devotee is, That's Vrindavan. What about this Vrindavan? Isn't this Vrindavan?
Not special.
Isn't it special? So what's the answer? Yes. So Vrindavan is full of devotees and Krishna's pastimes are still going on. So therefore it is special. That is, this is also a very special place. Of course. There is some very nice quote from Prabhupada about it. Oh yeah. It's actually, but the main thing is where your consciousness is at. One devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, what's the difference between Goloka Vrindavan and Gokula? Gokula and Goloka. So Srila Prabhupada said, there's no difference, but your consciousness is in America. So this is the point. You may be in Vrindavan, but it depends what you're thinking of. If you're in Vrindavan and you're thinking of going to America or doing things like that, so then where are you? Yeah.
We hear that Vrindavan is the holy place, and all holy places are in Vrindavan.
All holy places are, that's true. Yes.
They are only in Vrindavan and they expand from Vrindavan, so there are so many
right.
other holy places. But originally,
they're all in Vrindavan. And they'll say the same thing in Mayapur too. And it's true, Mayapur and Vrindavan are non-different. But the original Prayag, the original Bhadrika Ashram, is all in Vrindavan. Okay, that's a good point.
Coming to Vrindavan is not just Tirtha Yatra, it's one of the five most important elements of devotional service.
Okay. So here's another good point from Nectar of Devotion. That coming to Vrindavan is not simply going to another holy place. It's one of the five most potent forms of devotional service. My question would be that couldn't, if you live like in a temple in New York, would that be considered living in a holy place? To some extent. Okay. All right. Verse 26. After the damsels of the heavenly planets bathe in the water, becomes yellowish and fragrant due to the kumkum from their bodies. Thus the she elephants come to bathe there with their wives. The she elephants, and they also. Thus the elephants come to bathe there with their wives, the she elephants, and they also drink the water, although they are not thirsty. So why do they drink the water, although they're not thirsty? Because it's very sweet now, because the demigods' wives have bathed there. The airplanes of the heavenly denizens are bedecked with pearls, gold, and many valuable jewels. The heavenly denizens are compared to clouds in the sky, decorated with occasional flashes of electric lightning. While traveling, the demigods passed over the forest known as Saugandhika, which is full of varieties of flowers, fruits, and desire trees. While passing over the forest, they also saw the regions of Yaksheshvara. Yaksheshvara is Kuvera. So when the Pandavas were in exile, they resided at the bottom of the mountain where Kuvera lived also. They resided there. In that time, Bhima went up the mountain because one beautiful lotus flower came floating down. So he went up that mountain and he fought with all the Yakshas to get that flower for Draupadi. And he won the battle. So this is, the Pandavas had a lila over here also, at that place. 29? Okay, so here's some contradictory comments by Srila Prabhupada himself. I also noticed that, but I couldn't figure it out myself. That why Prabhupada said one thing in one purport. In verse 28, he says it's not Kuvera's abode is near Kailash. And in purport of 23, he says, Kuvera's abode is not near Kailash. So that's a bit something I couldn't understand myself either. Because I was always under the impression that it was near Kailash. And the Mahabharata also, there is that it's near Kailash. So why that comment? I couldn't figure that out. So let's see, verse 28 and verse 23. Can't be seen from Kailash. Alaka is different from the Alaka Puri of Kuvera. Okay, well, maybe nearby, but it may not be seen. So that way you can reconcile it. You may not be able to see it, although it's maybe nearby. Because the distances are probably not like the distances we have here. There are yojanas, and there are probably different planes of existence and all kinds of things which we can't see. It's not visible to the human eye. So different levels of existence. So verse 29. In that celestial forest, there are many birds whose necks were colored reddish and whose sweet sounds mixed with the humming of the bees. The lakes were abundantly decorated with crying swans as well as strong-stemmed lotus flowers. All these atmospheric influences unsettled the forest elephants who flocked together in the sandalwood forest, and the blowing wind agitated the minds of the damsels there for further sexual enjoyment. So Prabhupada in purport explains the difference between the atmosphere in the material world and the atmosphere in the spiritual world. That here, just a slight agitation makes someone desire to enjoy sexually. But in the spiritual world, there's so much more beautiful and there's so much more cause for agitation, but nobody is agitated. Despite, Prabhupada says, the pleasant atmosphere, the minds of the denizens do not become agitated, because in the spiritual world, Vaikuntha planets, spiritual minds, spiritualistic minds of the inhabitants are so much absorbed in the spiritual vibration of chanting glories of the Lord that such enjoyment could not be surpassed by any other enjoyment, even sex, which is a culmination of all pleasure in the material world. So last year I remember we were reading about how it was in Vaikuntha, and the husbands and wives were traveling in their airplanes, and then sometimes a breeze would come, and the breeze that would disturb them. They would say, oh, this is terrible, it's disturbing our chanting. The nice breeze would come. Here it agitates them to enjoy, but there, oh, this breeze is really disturbing us. Although it's a beautiful, nice scented breeze, but it's disturbing our chanting. They don't want anything to do with it. So actually, I have a nice story here. Well, let's read the end of this purport. In other words, in the Vaikuntha world, in spite of its better atmosphere and facilities, there is no impetus for sex life. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, param dishtva nivartate, the inhabitants are so spiritually enlightened that in the presence of such spirituality, sex life is insignificant. So this is true in the spiritual world, but here in the material world as devotees, we struggle sometimes with these problems. And we may not be so absorbed that we can forget all these things. But, sometimes. But if actually we love our spiritual master and are dedicated to his instructions, then we can overcome these problems when the temptation arises. I've got a nice example of Giriraj Maharaj when he was a brahmachari. When he was 24 years old, he was in Bombay fighting this terrible, huge battle with Mr. Nair for the land, the Juhu land. So at one point, Mr. Nair sent one young girl to try and allure Giriraj Swami, or he was a Giriraj Das. So somehow he was going in a car. He went inside one car, and she went in the back seat with him. And she was trying to make him agitate, touching him and everything. And so Giriraj Maharaj revealed his mind in one Bhagavatam class. He said, my first thought is, I will reciprocate with her and suffer the reactions later. Then he thought, but if I do reciprocate, there will be a big scandal. And it will be a bad reflection in our society. And Srila Prabhupada will hear about it. And it will cause him pain. So when this thought came in his mind, the thought of Prabhupada getting pain was so painful for Giriraj that he gave up the idea. So in this way, we can also overcome the temptation. And when we get into these awkward situations and remain fixed in our service. Verse 31. They also saw that the bathing ghats in their staircases were made of vaidurya-mani. The water was full of lotus flowers. Passing by such lakes, the demigods reach a place where there is a great banyan tree. That banyan tree was 800 miles high, and its branches spread over 600 miles around. The tree cast a fine shade which permanently cooled the atmosphere, the temperature, yet there was no noise of birds. The demigods saw Lord Shiva sitting under that tree, which was competent to give perfection to mystic yogis and deliver all people. As grave as time eternal, he appeared to have given up all anger. So Prabhupada, in the second paragraph, picks up one of the Sanskrit words, maha. So this comes from the affix mahat. And this means there were a large number or quantity. So maha yoga indicates there were so many great yogis and devotees meditating on the form of Lord Vishnu. So we'll find out later on, there is a word describing Lord Shiva, which is Yogishwara, Yogishwara. So just see the opulence. Now we're starting to understand the position of Lord Shiva. He is so great that many yogis and many devotees are sitting with him, meditating on Vishnu. 34. Lord Shiva sat there, surrounded by saintly persons like Kuvera, master of the Guyakas, and the four Kumaras, who were already liberated souls. Lord Shiva was grave and saintly. So what is the significance of the four Kumaras and Kuvera sitting with Lord Shiva? What does this tell us? Yeah? All material opulence is Kuvera. All spiritual opulence. So we've got all material opulence and also renunciation of all the opulence, I was thinking. We've got Jnana and we've got Aishwarya. So the criticism of Daksha is completely unfounded, as we see here. He's surrounded by great, great personalities. Personification of wealth and the personification of renunciation. Now, verse 35. Vidya tapaya kapatam astitam tam adisharam charantam vishva suhidam vatsaya lokamangalam. So very nice words describing Lord Shiva. The demigods saw Lord Shiva situated in his perfection as a master of the senses, knowledge, fruit of activities, and the path of achieving perfection. He was the friend of the entire world. And by virtue of his full affection for everyone, he was very auspicious. So here in the Sanskrit it says, Vatsalya Lokamangalam, full of affection and auspicious. Why is he described as Lokamangalam in this purport? Why is he auspicious for everyone? Yes, he teaches devotional service. So that's what Prabhupada says in the purport. How to engage in devotional service? 24 hours a day. So we learned in the fourth chapter, he is also called very auspicious, Shiva. Why was he called auspicious in that verse, in 4.4.14 actually? Sati is saying that Shiva is very auspicious for some type of persons. For the Bhutas. Bhutarat. He's called Bhutarat, Lord of the Bhutas. Why is he auspicious for them? He lifts them up, yeah. Prabhupada says if such persons take shelter of Lord Shiva, they will understand they're not the material body, but our spirit soul. So this is the position of Lord Shiva, why he is so auspicious. Why would he be called Vatsala? Why should he have this affection? There's a reason behind it. Why does he have affection for all living entities? Well, pure devotee, there's another reason. Of course, all devotees love all living entities. There's another reason, too. Another reason. Yeah, devotees have compassion. But why? I'm saying why. He's the father. He's the father of all living entities. Lord Brahma will bring up this argument. We'll hear this later on. 36. He was seated on a deerskin and was practicing all forms of austerity. Because his body was smeared with ashes, he looked like an evening cloud. On his hair was the sign of half-moon symbolic representation. So let's see, we're in verse 36. Lord Shiva's symptoms of austerity are not exactly those of a Vaishnava. What does he do that we don't do? He goes around naked and he puts ashes and he wears skulls, for one. Okay? He exhibits a feature for the... Lord Shiva is certainly the number one Vaishnava, but he exhibits a feature for a particular class of men who cannot follow the Vaishnava principles. The Shaivites, devotees of Lord Shiva, generally dress like Lord Shiva, and sometimes they indulge in smoking and taking intoxicants. Such practices are never accepted by the followers of Vaishnava rituals. So next question is, why does he have a half moon on his head? It's quite an interesting symbol. Why? There's a lot of reasons for it. At least two. Yes? No, it's got nothing to do with the Ganga. Because the half moon is a mark on Krishna's lotus feet. And it symbolizes that he keeps the soles of Krishna's feet is like a decoration on his head. So he decorates his head with Krishna's lotus feet. So that's the half moon. Plus, there's a whole other story here about the moon and Lord Shiva's head from Brahma Vaivarta Purana. And this also, again, involves Daksha. So the story goes that the moon god had 27 wives, but he only liked one of them, and that was Rohini, and he was neglecting all the other wives. So all of them were daughters of Daksha, of course, and they went to their father and complained that he's not giving us attention. So then Daksha cursed the moon to have TB. So he was, day by day, he was losing his strength. So then the moon went and took shelter of Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva took away his disease and put him on his head. But then because he was on Lord Shiva's head, all the wives got upset again because he wasn't with them anymore. So then again they went to Daksha and complained. So then Daksha went over to Lord Shiva and he said, if you don't give back Chandra to me for my daughters, I will curse you. So then Lord Shiva said, you may reduce me to ashes or curse me as you like, but I cannot return the moon who has taken shelter of me, because I will not return the moon. And then so then Daksha was preparing to curse Lord Shiva. And then Lord Shiva thought immediately of Krishna, and Krishna came immediately in the form of a Brahmin, a very old Brahmin. And both Lord Shiva and Daksha bowed down before the Brahmin. And the Lord, in the form of a Brahmin, said, oh, Shiva, nothing is dearer to all creatures than themselves. So considering this, you should save yourself and give the moon back to Daksha. So now he gives a lot of arguments. You are the best of the renunciants, you are calm, you are the best Vaishnava, you treat everyone equally, you're free from violence and anger. And Daksha is an illustrious son of Brahma, full of anger. So a noble person gives in before an angry person. This is what Krishna said to him. So for noble person gives in before an angry person. So therefore you should give the moon back to Daksha. And Lord Shiva smiled and said, I can sacrifice all my austerities, my glory, my achievements, my riches, and my life, but I cannot abandon a person who has taken shelter of me. One who turns away a person who has taken shelter of them is abandoned by dharma. I can disown anything except dharma. Then he recognizes it's Krishna. You are aware of dharma. Why do you speak words influenced by illusion? You are the creator and destroyer of everything. One who is devoted to you cannot be afraid of anyone. So then what the Lord did, he took the half of the moon that was sick and he gave it to Daksha. And then he kept the half of the moon that was well and he gave it to Shiva on top of his head. So that's why Shiva has half a moon. So then, of course, now they've got the problem again with the sick moon. So then Daksha prayed to Lord Krishna and he arranged that the moon would be full. During one fortnight, it would become healthy, and then the other fortnight would decrease. So both of them got the blessings of Krishna, and Lord Shiva still has the moon on his head, and then the other moon sometimes has a bright fortnight and a dark fortnight. So this is from Brahma Vaivarta Purana, story of the moon. 37. He was seated on a straw mattress and speaking to all present, including the great sage Narada, to whom he specifically spoke about the absolute truth. So here, the absolute truth. Prabhupada says in the purport, it must be devotional service. They have to be discussing devotional service. So why must it be devotional service? Why does it have, yeah. They're Mahajans. Narada and Lord Shiva. Two Mahajans, they get together and they're speaking about devotional service. So in the purport, Prabhupada says, Narada was asking Lord Shiva about devotional service, and Shiva, being the topmost Vaishnava, was instructing him. So here's another example how Lord Shiva is guru. He's guru of Narada. He was instructing Narada about devotional service. Another point is that Lord Shiva is the supreme instructor, and the great sage Narada is the supreme audience. Therefore, the supreme subject matter of Vedic knowledge is bhakti, or devotional service. Verse 38. His left leg was placed on his right thigh, and his left hand was placed on his left thigh. In his right hand, he held Rudraksha beads. This sitting posture is called Virasan. He sat in the Virasan posture, and his finger was in the mode of argument. So what is this Tarka Mudra, Prabhupada says? Tarka Mudra. Can anybody demonstrate? Tarka Mudra. This is the mode of argument. Like that? Like, finger was in the mode of argument. Anybody know mudras? Like this? Or like this? I don't know. Okay, nobody. All right, Tarka Mudra. Now, at the end of the purport, there's something very important here. There's two words, so we should know the difference between these two Sanskrit words. One is Yogishvara, and the other is Yogeshvara. So what's the difference between Yogishvara and Yogeshvara? Yogishvara means? Noel, according to the purport, it says Yogishvara indicates no one can surpass the yoga practice of Lord Shiva. And Yogeshvara indicates no one can surpass the yogic perfection of Krishna. So one is practice and one is perfection, it seems. This is in the end of the purport. Master of all yogis. And Krishna is called Yogeshvara. Oh, in my folio it's different then. Okay. See, I copied this from folio. There's a difference between... It's the same? Shiva is called Yogeshvara, the master of all yogis. Oh yeah, it's the same. It's the same. I was going the sentence down. Lord Shiva is called Yogeshvara, master of all yogis. Right. And Krishna is called Yogeshvara, master of all yogis. Right. So then Yogeshvara indicates no one can surpass the yoga practice of Lord Shiva. Yogeshvara indicates no one can surpass yogic perfection. So I notice the difference. One is practice, one is perfection. Yogeshvara and Yogeshvara. So Lord Shiva is practicing and Krishna is the perfection, has the perfection of all yoga. Interesting distinction Srila Prabhupada makes here, purport. Verse 30. It does. The fingers are open. Second finger is raised with the arm to impress the audience with some subject matter. Okay? Whatever it is. All the fingers are open. Second finger is raised. Anyway, whoever knows yoga can teach us that. 39. All the sages and demigods, headed by Indra, offered their respectful obeisances unto Lord Shiva with folded hands. Lord Shiva was dressed in saffron garments and absorbed in trance, thus appearing to be the foremost of all sages. So now he's in saffron. He lost his wife. It's like this? He explains. Okay. Sridhar Swami. Like this. Chastising finger. Ooh. Like this. Taka Mudra. Okay.
But that's just the Prabhupada says the fingers are open.
Okay, so we have a difference between Prabhupada's purport and Srila Swami. Verse 39 purport. Prabhupada picks out a word, Sanskrit words, in the last paragraph. The words manunam adyam are significant here because they mean a philosopher, or one who is thoughtful and can think very nicely. Such a man is called Manu. So Prabhupada explains, why is Lord Shiva called the chief of all thinkers? Manunam. What is he thinking of? In other words, what is his thoughtfulness? Yes. How to save the demons from their fallen condition of life. So this is a very beautiful purport. It is said that during the advent of Lord Chaitanya, Sadashiva appeared as Advaita Prabhu. And Advaita Prabhu's chief concern was to elevate the fallen condition souls to the platform of devotional service to Lord Krishna. Since people were engaged in useless occupations, which would continue their material existence, Lord Shiva, in the form of Lord Advaita, appealed to the Supreme Lord to appear as Lord Chaitanya to deliver these illusioned souls. Actually, Lord Chaitanya appeared on the request of Lord Advaita. Similarly, Lord Shiva has a sampradaya, the Rudra sampradaya. He's always thinking about the deliverance of the fallen souls, as exhibited by Lord Advaita Prabhu. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, 6th chapter, verse 79, the position of Sadashiva, Rudra, who is an expansion of Sadashira, is a guna avatar and the ornament of all demigods. In the Vayu Purana, there is a description of Sadashiva in one of the Vaikuntha planets. So the original Sadashiva is in Vaikuntha. It says that Sadashiva is a direct expansion of Lord Krishna's form for pastimes. It is said that Sadashiva, Lord Shambhu, is an expansion from the Sadashiva in the Vaikuntha planets. And his consort Mahamaya is an expansion of Ramadevi or Lakshmi. So there we have it, that the original Sadashiva is in Vaikuntha. Sometimes that question comes up. Now, what is the mood of Sadashiva? That is described in Adi Lila, 6th chapter, verse 80. 80, 80. Teokoren Krishna dasha patyash nirantara kai shiva mui Krishna dash. He desires only to be a servant of Lord Krishna. Shri Sadashiva always says, I am a servant of Lord Krishna. Intoxicated by ecstatic love for Krishna, he becomes overwhelmed and incessantly dances without clothes on and sings about Lord Krishna's qualities and pastimes. He says, Chaitanya radashamui, Chaitanya radash, Chaitanya radashamui, taradashya dash. I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, servant of Lord Chaitanya, servant of Lord Chaitanya, and a servant of his servants. So this is the mood of Advaita Prabhu, who is actually Lord Shiva, Sadashiva. So Advaita, if you want very quick mercy, you pray to Lord Advaita Prabhu. You go to Mayapur and you see the Panchatapa. Advaita is very, he's showing with his hand, he's showing, here is Lord Chaitanya. He's giving us. He called Lord Chaitanya to come and now he's giving us Lord Chaitanya. Yes. Yeah, the reflection of the glance of Maharaj. Yes, Advaita, he's also seen as Mahavishnu. Yes. Yeah, there's a connection. They're intimately connected, Mahavishnu and Lord Shiva. Right. Right. More Mahavishnu. It's Lord Shiva in his pure form. Right. So here in Chaitanya Bhagavat, I'll just read a very short portion here, again about Advaita Prabhu, how showing his great mercy for the fallen souls, that one time he was dancing for Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Lord Chaitanya said, please ask me for a benediction. And Advaita said, what can I ask? Whatever I desired, I have received. You have come here. So I'm completely satisfied. So then Lord Chaitanya said, I'll preach the chanting of the holy names from house to house, so the entire universe will dance as they sing my glories. I will distribute devotional service for which personalities headed by Brahma, Shiva, and Narada undergo austerities. So this I assure you. Advaita said, if you will distribute devotional service, then give it to the less intelligent persons, the women and Shudras. Let the sinful people, proud of their education, wealth, high birth, and austerities, and those who place obstacles in the path of your devotees in your devotional service, burn to death. And let all others, including the dog-eaters, dance while singing your holy names and qualities. So what does this mean, these people burn to death? Prabhupada says, the purport says, it's quoted by from Bhaktisiddhanta, let them burn to death with envy on seeing the devotees from all classes of the world having devotional service. So then Advaita Prabhu said, even the dog-eaters are dancing and singing the glories of the Lord, while the Bhattas, Mishras, and Chakravartis are engaged in criticism. So this is heavy from Chaitanya Bhagavat, that they are criticizing, but the dog-eaters are dancing and happy, ecstatic, and in the holy name. This is Chaitanya Bhagavat, chapter 6 of Madhya 6, verses 158 up through 172, Chaitanya Bhagavat. So it's the mood of Advaita Prabhu that he wants to distribute to the lowest of the low. So therefore we can thank Lord Shiva, Lord Advaita, for this mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Verse 40. So now we're going to start from verse 42. We'll see the prayers. Or actually, this is not demigods. That's a mistake. It should be Brahma. This is Lord Brahma, who is trying to be a mediator here. The first mediator, I believe. The first one failed, and now we're having a second attempt at mediation from verse 42. He's going to be the mediator between the demigods and Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva's lotus feet were worshipped by both the demigods and demons. But still, in spite of his exalted position, as soon as he saw that Lord Brahma was there among all the other demigods, he immediately stood up and offered him respect by bowing down and touching his lotus feet, just as Vamanadeva offered his respectful obeisances to Kashyap Muni. So Vamana was the incarnation of Lord Vishnu. He offered obeisances to Kashyap, his father. So Lord Shiva is the incarnation of motive ignorance. He's beyond Jiva Tattva, but he's offering obeisances to his father, Lord Brahma. Verse 41. All the sages who were sitting with Lord Shiva, such as Narada and others, also offered their respectful obeisances to Lord Brahma. After being so worshipped, Lord Brahma, smiling, began to speak to Lord Shiva. Why is Lord Brahma smiling? He's a mediator here. He's nervous. He's nervous about this mediation. Prabhupada says that in the purport. Lord Brahma was smiling because he knew that Lord Shiva is not only easily satisfied, but easily irritated as well. He was afraid that Lord Shiva might be in an angry mood because he had lost his wife and been insulted by Daksha. In order to conceal this fear, he smiled and addressed Lord Shiva as follows. So he was smiling, you know, trying to placate, pacify Lord Shiva and to cover over his fear about his duty here of mediation. So although Brahma, before he told the demigods, don't worry, Lord Shiva is easily pleased. But when he actually got there, he kind of got nervous about this. That happens to us, you know. Before we're thinking, oh, no, no problem, I can do this service. But then it comes time and you get nervous. 42. So what Lord Brahma says to Lord Shiva. Janetam isham vishvasya jagato yoni bijaya shakti shivasya cha param yattad brahma nirantaram. Lord Brahma said, my dear Lord Shiva, I know you are the controller of the entire material manifestation. combination father and mother of the cosmic manifestation and the supreme Brahman beyond the cosmic manifestation as well. I know you in that way. So very, very praising words. So these verses from 40 up to 49, where Brahma tries to influence him in a very humble way, glorifying him. You're the creator. You're the destroyer. Did he mention destroyer? No. Controller, father and mother. He's not going to mention destruction at this point because we already had enough of that. So controller, father and mother. So why is he? Why would he say something like that? Your father and mother. Why would he say that as an argument to placate Lord Shiva? Compassion. Yes. He's coming as a... Brahma is representing the demigods. The demigods are his children. So he should be merciful to them. They are like his children. So you should be merciful. So then in verse 43, my dear Lord, you create this cosmic manifestation, maintain it, and annihilate it by expansion of your personality, exactly as a spider creates, maintains, and winds up its web. So here Prabhupada says, Shiva Shakti. Shiva Shakti. This Shiva Shakti is significant. Shiva means auspicious, and Shakti means energy. Has anybody heard this word, Shiva Shakti, before? Yeah. Yes. What's that? Shiva Shakti. Yes. Sometimes we hear it in different connections. The energy of Lord Shiva, Shiva Shakti. There's a tattva. Oh, and Dashamala tattva. Shiva Shakti is there, covered. Okay. So if you want to know about Shiva Shakti, you'll hear about it soon in Dashamala tattva. So Prabhupada, at the end of the purport, says, the mode of ignorance, or tamogun, is considered very much lower than the others. But in the higher sense, it is also auspicious. The example may be given herein. The government has both an educational department and criminal department. An outsider may consider criminal department inauspicious. But from the government's point of view, it is as important as the education department. And therefore, the government finances both departments equally without discrimination. So, Brajbihari Prabhu, would you say this approach of Brahma is a good approach in mediation? What do you usually do? What's the first thing you do when you approach a problem like this? Lord Shiva, okay. Well, I guess it's different. You have to offer prayers and...
Yeah, well, he's doing exactly right because you approach things according to time, place, and circumstance.
Okay, so in that sense, he's doing time, place, and circumstance. He's offering prayers. So somebody like Lord Shiva, the first thing is you offer prayers. And he's trying to get his compassionate side, the relationship showing this. You know, these people are your relatives, they're your children. Okay, so he's trying to prepare his frame of mind. You're the controller. You're the father of these. Seems to me like he's trying to invoke his compassion because there's a relationship. They're your children, actually. You know, you're the father, and they're your children. So therefore, you shouldn't be too heavy. Yeah. Should we?
Yeah, because in a sense,
it's trying to. Yes. You can take it, yeah, so you don't have to take it too seriously. In a sense, it's true because we'll find later on that Lord Shiva and Vishnu are practically non-different in one sense. They're very close to each other in one sense. They're non-different. So,
it does get,
especially if we've never heard Lord Shiva addressed as all these things. But even in Brahma Samhita, Durga is just Shisti, Stiti, Palaya, Sadhana, Shakti, Rekha, creation, maintenance, destruction. Even Durga is addressed in that way. So it is true because by the combination of Durga and Shiva, the material creation is brought about in one sense. At one point, that happens, that they combine and there is production. Yes. Oh yeah, here he's called Bhagavan. Yes. Narada? Narada, Shukadev, they're called Bhagavan. Yes. Okay, so you're bringing up the point, it's not necessarily like that. But there is truth in it, actually, if you research it. That he is involved in creation, maintenance, and destruction. As Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said in his purport in the Brahma Samhita that we heard. Yes? Yes. Yes. So if you look at it in the sense that he's an incarnation, a guna avatar. Yes. It must be sincere. Yes. He's not just saying these things. Yeah. No, but still, he's the authority of the universe, so he's going to say things. Yeah. Yeah, I would not think so. And Prabhupada is actually supporting what Lord Brahma says in purport. So I think we would have to take it as he's explaining how he's auspicious. He's explaining how it is. He's explaining. Yes, right. Yeah, there was a where Daksha was called Mahatma yesterday in the verse, and Prabhupada said this is sarcastic. He's being sarcastic. He doesn't really mean Daksha is Mahatma. So, but this is actually true. So, verse 44. My dear Lord, your Lordship has introduced a system of sacrifices through the agency of Daksha, and thus one may derive the benefits of religious activities and economic development under your regulative principles. The institution of the four varnas and ashrams is respected. The brahmanas therefore vow to follow this system strictly. So here, what argument is this? You know, why is he talking about varnashram and all the sacrifices? What's the argument here? Yeah. Yes. So Daksha is through Daksha you've introduced, he says. Through Daksha you are giving us varnashram, sacrifices. So if you're establishing it, now you've killed Daksha, how can you maintain it? That it's through Daksha you've given him the responsibility to introduce the system of sacrifice. So how is it that now you're killing him? This doesn't seem right. So this is Brahma. And now here's another, next argument. O most auspicious Lord, you have ordained the heavenly planets, the spiritual Vaikuntha planets, and the impersonal Brahman sphere as the respective destinations of the performers of auspicious activities. Similarly, for others who are miscreants, you have destined different kinds of hells, which are horrible and ghastly. Yet sometimes it is found their destinations are just the opposite. It is very difficult to ascertain the cause of this. So this is, he's saying, well, you know, Prabhupada gives the example in the purport that sinful Ajamila went to Vaikuntha and pious Daksha is going to hell. So how is this? He's a Brahmin, he's son of Lord Brahma, he's the head of the Prajapatis, and he's going to hell? And you made this system of karma, so this doesn't seem just. This doesn't seem fair. But then the end of the purport, well, before the end of the purport, there's a verse, how the devotee sees calamities. Tatenukampam susamikshamana punjana evatma kitam vipakam idvakpapurbir viratan namaste jivetayo mukti pade sutayaka. Purport of this verse is that when a devotee is in a calamitous condition, he takes it as a benediction of the Supreme Lord and takes responsibility himself for his past misdeeds. So what's the opposite of taking responsibility for yourself? Blaming it, it's his fault, he did it, she did it, it's their fault. They're doing this to me. No. That's not the Krishna conscious position. In such a condition, he offers still more devotional service and is not disturbed. One who lives in such a disposition of mind, engaged in devotional service, is the most eligible candidate for promotion to the spiritual world. In other words, such a devotee's claim for promotion to the spiritual world is assured in all circumstances. So here Prabhupada slips some philosophical application here for us, that if suppose we were daksha and we got that punishment, then this should be our... Of course, he's not alive to appreciate it, but he will be soon. Yeah. Yes. And yeah, we will see that in the following purports, I think, in the following verses, that what was his... He had a misconception. He had a misconception that was behind his behavior. So what was that misconception?
He was seeing himself.
What is the level of devotional service that this is?
Kanishadikari.
They see it's only me and Krishna, or me and my guru and Krishna, and everyone else, I don't care.
It's called the name of the action,
yeah. Yeah. He doesn't see other living entities. But there's another point here. Fruit of activities are not worth it, this karmakanda, sacrifices, because just a little misunderstanding and he got such a heavy punishment. That's Prabhupada's making that point. Yeah. Let's go on. Verse 46. My dear Lord, devotees who have fully dedicated their lives unto your lotus feet certainly observe your presence as Paramatma in each and every being. And as such, they do not differentiate between one living being and another. Such persons treat all living entities equally. They never become overwhelmed by anger, like animals, who can see nothing without differentiation. So now what is he telling Lord Shiva? You should not be angry. You're like Paramatma, or you are Paramatma. Paramatma doesn't get angry. Yeah. Okay, so those overwhelmed by anger are like animals. So how is it Lord Shiva is like Paramatma, or is Paramatma in one sense? In what sense do we understand Lord Shiva is Paramatma? Okay, that's one way, transparent via medium. There's another, he's directly connected in one sense, actually. Yeah.
Trikalagya.
Connect directly. But he...
Yeah.
What?
Shiva and Krishna are very similar.
Very similar. But it... Okay. Anyway, you probably won't get it. Yeah? Actually, how he's like Paramatma is that he is the incarnation of time. He's the time. He's the expansion of Paramatma as time. So internally, there's Paramatma. Externally, there's Kala, time. And Queen Kunti mentioned this in her prayer, Manye Tvam Kalam Ishanam, that Paramatma and Kala is, Paramatma is Kala, time, the witness of everything. Paramatma is the witness and he gives the reactions, and this is all due to time. So Lord Shiva is actually personification of time.
Kala Smi,
yes. That's yeah, yes. And what is this Kala? Who is this Kala? It's Shiva. It's Kala is Shiva. Kala Smi, of course it's Krishna. Everything is Krishna. But in this world, even in one place where that verse in chapter 3, no, not that verse. Anyway, it was that verse in chapter 14 about Sarva Yoni Shukanteya. Sometimes Prabhupada says this means actually Lord Shiva and Parvati are the mother and father, because Krishna doesn't marry the material, he has no connection with material nature. So if material nature is the mother, Lord Shiva must be the father, because he's the one who connects with mother nature. Yeah. Shiva means Atma, yes. Yes, he's Atma. So he's Paramatma. He's in everyone's heart. Also in another sense, he's in everyone's heart as the Ahankara, representing Ahankara. Where is this in fourth canto? Shiva is the function of Lord Krishna in the material world, obviously. So he's the father and the mother. Okay. We're in verse 46. Here in the prayer part, Prabhupada makes a nice point that When the Lord becomes angry or kills a demon, materially this may appear unfavorable, but spiritually it is a blissful blessing upon him. Therefore, pure devotees do not make any distinction between the Lord's anger and his blessings. So the devotee does not find fault. Again, in the previous purport, no one can argue with the supreme judgment. It is supreme. Verse 47. Persons who observe everything with differentiation, who are simply attached to fruitive activities, who are mean-minded, who are always pained to see the flourishing condition of others, who thus give distress to them by uttering harsh and piercing words, have already been killed by providence. Thus, there is no need for them to be killed again by such an exalted personality like you. So, here again, the description of the person in the Sanskrit, there's an important word, the first word, pritak diya, separatist mentality. This is describing Daksha and people like him who have a separatist. And the third canto, bhinadrik, separate vision, pritak bhava, separatist. So these are all, what's that? 1514, separate. So bhinadusham, separate vision. This is, so these kind of people who have this vision, they don't need to be killed by you. They're already dead. They're atmaha, Ishopanishad says, killer of the soul. They're already dead. You don't need to kill them again. So Lord Brahma is saying, you don't need to kill Daksha. Of course, he's already dead. He said, you didn't need to kill him. He's already dead. So here in the purport, at end of paragraph 1, Śrīla Prabhupāda says, a Vaishnava is described as Pāra Dukkaduki, because although he is never distressed in any condition of life, he is distressed to see others in a distressed condition. Vaishnavas, therefore, should not try to kill by any action of the body or mind. How can you kill someone by your mind? Yes, we're on the verbal. What can you do on the mental?
Neglect.
Neglect?
Think okay. Bad thoughts.
Think bad thoughts.
Send bad vibes.
Huh? Okay, so now we're getting... Okay, anyway, it's enough of that. So, we don't want to kill anyone by action of the body or mind, but should try to revive... Yeah, psychologically you can do something, I think. There's ways. Yeah.
It says that should be done, should be followed not only by the body, but also by words and mind.
You should not wish bad to anyone or death to anyone. So this is ahimsa of the mind. Yeah, there is Bhagavad Gita tells austerity of the mind. Is it always thinking of the welfare of others? I don't know. Is that one of them? Austerity of the mind. So yes, in Vrindavan this is important also, very important. We should try to revive the Krishna consciousness of others out of compassion for them. So here, Lord Brahma is saying that he's already killed. And we often hear this, that the people of Kali Yuga have already killed themselves in this. How have they already killed themselves in this age of Kali? What is the death of the people of this modern civilization? Yeah.
No interest in self-realization.
Not only no interest, the opposite, or they try to stop people who are interested. So what is our weapon in this age of Kali? Prasadam?
Love.
What?
Love.
Weapon of love. Chanting, yes, chanting Hare Krishna. The weapon of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Here Prabhupada says in Science of Self-Realization, his weapon is the Sankirtan movement. He killed the demonic mentality of the people by introducing the Sankirtan movement, and that is the significance of Lord Chaitanya. Prabhupada said, people are already killing themselves. You don't have to kill them. They've discovered atomic weapons to kill more quickly, so God doesn't have to worry about killing them. But he came to kill their demonic mentality. So this is the commentary on this verse. Verse, yeah.
I want to say that I also saw this purport here as for us to explain people how to apply Sati's words.
How to apply Sati's words. Good.
So we saw before, by becoming Krishna conscious.
Yes.
And this time, said one should kill the offender, and the Buddha says one should reform the offender.
Okay, so this is very important. Remember that verse in fourth chapter where Sati said you should either leave, if you hear blasphemy, you should leave the place, 4.4.17. You should leave the place, you should cut out the tongue and kill the person, or you should kill yourself. So here, the explanation of killing is to kill the demoniac mentality. That's how you should kill yourself and anyone else. Revive their Krishna consciousness. Yes?
I would like to say that she expresses that in great anger.
Yes, of course she's angry.
And therefore,
but it's quoted in Nectar of Devotion.
That same verse.
Yes, I believe.
Yeah,
well, Prabhupada did give us the application of leaving the place, but now here we have a further, more compassionate application than leaving the place, is to, if possible, if you can, make the person Krishna conscious. But if it's a demoniac person and you're Kanishtha Adhikara, you better leave the place. And if it's a demoniac person and you're Madhyam, there might be a possibility of doing something, but not if they're two. Madhyams also don't preach to the demons. But if you're an Uttam, there might be some possibility. Yeah?
The second time Prabhu brought up an interesting point. So, just as, in my mind, just as a kancha is pure, even though it's made of gold, committing sati is pure because it follows the Vedic principles.
Well, the Vedic. Did you say that? He didn't say that. I don't know where you heard that. I didn't hear it.
No. But she spoke at that point.
Spoke. Spoke is the word.
Was spoken in great anger.
Yeah.
And
it's nothing to do with ghosts. No, she was angry when she said it. He's saying, so we should consider. She spoke it in anger. Nothing to do with sati.
That would be an anger also.
Yeah. Okay, we got to keep going here. And then we'll have some more comments. This is the last one. Okay, we're going to hear from Jiva Goswami now. Pay attention.
Even if those who are like you have been restored.
Now, wait. Jiva Goswami is... What is he talking about here? What context?
Which verse?
47, okay.
There is no need for them to be killed again by...
Even those who are like you, Bhavadvita, like Shiva.
So what do you say about you personally, yourself?
Yeah, oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay, I got it. See the last sentence in the verse. There is no need for them to be killed again by an exalted personality like you. So he's implying also you. He's saying, he's not saying, he's indirect. He's saying personalities like you.
What to say about yourself?
What to speak about yourself?
Even those who are like you,
do not kill. So why should you do this? Okay, now we're going to verse 48, which says another argument. He's very expert, Lord Brahma, isn't he? All these different arguments. My dear Lord, and we need to flip the flip chart. My dear Lord, if in some places materialists who are already bewildered by the insurmountable illusory energy of a supreme Godhead sometimes commit offenses, a saintly person with compassion does not take this seriously. Knowing that they commit offenses because they are overpowered by the illusory energy, he does not show his prowess to counteract them. So now he's calling Lord Shiva a sadhu. You are a saintly person. You should forgive. Even if someone makes offense, you should not be angry. You are Paramatma, you are sadhu, you are this, you are that. You made all the rules. So you should not do this. Brijan gives a nice example why we should not be angry if someone offends us. Suppose, imagine you're in a rowboat on a lake and it's foggy and you're rowing the boat. And suddenly you see another boat outline is coming closer and it crashes into your boat. What is your reaction? angry at the people in the boat. But if you look in the boat and no one's in the boat, who do you get angry at? So that was his example for this. So the anger goes away. That was his, huh? I don't know what it means. He's going to explain it. I'll explain it. So Brahma is suggesting to Lord Shiva, when someone like Daksha does something horrible, it isn't him doing it. It's the material energy of ignorance working through him. So you don't have to show your powers by counteracting it in that way. So that was what his example was. So I like this purport. It's very beautiful, the beginning of it. It is said, the beauty of a tapasvi, or saintly person, is forgiveness. There are many instances in the spiritual history of the world in which many saintly persons, although unnecessarily harassed, did not take action, although they could have done so. Just give me one example of somebody who was harassed. Ambarish, Chitaketu, Haridas, Parikshit, so many. So in the purport, at the end, a Vaishnava is personally tolerant for the benefit of others. When he does not show his prowess, this does not mean he is lacking in strength. Somebody says, oh, you're just a weakling, that's why you're not getting angry. Rather, it indicates he is tolerant for the welfare of the entire human society. So just imagine a devotee, if you're tolerant, you're not just tolerating for yourself, you're tolerating for the whole human society. What's that? Vasudev Dutt. So that's all devotees, they tolerate. To be a devotee means you're representative of Krishna. So whatever you do, you're representing Krishna and you're doing on behalf of the whole human society. So that is the behavior of a Vaishnava. In fact, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said, if you want to understand religious principles in this age of Kali, then you should study the behavior of a Vaishnava, and that's where you will find religious principles. So the first part of this purport, I want to go back, talks about forgiveness. And in the 9th canto, 15, verse 39, Jamadagni says to Parashuram, my dear son, we are Brahmins and have become worshipable for the people in general because of our quality of forgiveness. So he's, you know, Parashuram. He's not going to be a forgiving type at all. But still his father was trying to teach him, you should forgive. Of course, when they killed his father, that was it. He just went and killed everyone. Still, this is 9:15:39. It is because of this quality, forgiveness, that Lord Brahma, the supreme spiritual master of this universe, has achieved his post. So if any of you want to be Brahma, just forgive. Now, in the next verse, there's a very beautiful purport by Srila Prabhupada. This is same, 9:15:40. The duty of a Brahmin is to culture the quality of forgiveness, which is illuminating like a sun. Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is pleased with those who are forgiving. So, without looking at your computers, I'm going to ask you a question about the purport. And of course, we did this last year, so those who remember. Prabhupada says, in the same way, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras become beautiful by their qualities. So what is the beauty of a Brahmin? Brahmins are beautiful when they are forgiving. Yeah, we're talking about forgiveness. That one's already there. So Kshatriyas are beautiful when? What? Forbearance? No, that's for the Brahmins. Courageous, yeah. When they don't run away from fighting, they're heroic. Vaishyas do two things, and they're beautiful. What's that? Honest? No. The beauty of a Kshatriya? Oh, sorry, Vaishya? No. Protect the cows, that's one. And when they protect the cows, and this one you'll never get, they enrich cultural activities. So they use their money for enriching cultural activities. These are this is the beauty of the beauty of a Shudra. Faithful in discharge of their duties. Thus everyone becomes beautiful by his special qualities. So the Brahmin is being emphasized that he is forgiving. Because Arjuna wanted to forgive in Bhagavad Gita, but
Krishna said, no, you're not a Brahmin. You're a Kshatriya, you don't forgive. You should fight. Yes. Yes. Who says this? Mansamita. Okay. Okay, if a Brahmin is not forgiving, he loses his tejas. Yeah. Oh well, if you curse, then you do lose. You lose a lot of your pious credits. If you curse, then you lose a lot of your pious credits. It uses up your pious credits by cursing. I heard that. You actually curse someone. In Kali Yuga, well, it happens. It happens. That he's heroic and doesn't run away from fighting. Verse 49. My dear Lord, you are never bewildered by the formidable influence of the illusory energy of Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, you are omniscient and should be merciful and compassionate toward those who are bewildered by the same illusory energy and are very much attached to fruitive activities. So here he's saying, you're an advanced devotee now. He's just a neophyte. Why are you being angry with him? He says, he's bewildered. He's under the illusion, and you're not. You're above it. So why should you... you shouldn't be bewildered. You should be merciful. So these are all arguments. Nice thing Prabhupada says at the end of the purport is about the Vaishnava, how he's merciful. A Vaishnava should take care of those who are bewildered by this Maya instead of becoming angry with them, because without a Vaishnava's mercy, they have no way to get out of the clutches of Maya. Those who have been condemned by Maya are rescued by the mercy of the Vaishnavas. Panchakalpa tirupyascha kripasindha pyevacha pachitanam bhavanebhya Vaishnavebhya namo namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances to all the Vaishnava devotees of the Lord. They are just like desire trees that can fulfill the desires of everyone, and they are full of compassion for the fallen conditioned souls. Those who are under the influence of the illusory energy are attracted to fruitive activities, but a Vaishnava preacher attracts their hearts to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. So this Prabhupada is giving us the mentality of the Vaishnava and also the technique of attracting. We're meant to attract the fallen souls, not to become angry with them. Sometimes devotees get angry in the course of their preaching, but Prabhupada doesn't agree with that technique of becoming angry with the conditioned souls. We should try, our method should be that we're so attractive. The devotees, Prabhupada said, they're very attractive. They are effulgent. So in that way, we should attract their hearts to Lord Krishna. 50. My dear Lord Shiva. So that's the end of his arguments. Wonderful arguments by Lord Shiva. All these, you're compassionate, you're a Vaishnava, you're so many things. You're not bewildered. Yes, Lord Brahma to Shiva. Lord Brahma is the mediator here between the demigods and Lord Shiva. Yes. I mean, well, he started out humble, but in the end he came, you go in like a needle and out like a plow, as we've heard. He went in very humbly, but then he started to get in a little bit. You're like this. He's saying, but you're advanced. So you're bewildered. You should be compassionate. He doesn't say... Those who are... Well, first he started, he was saying, not you, like you. Saintly persons like you, they're like this. But now at the end, he's saying, he's being very direct. You're not bewildered. He's being more direct. You're omniscient. You're merciful. You're Paramatma. You're so many things. Yeah, right. So... My dear Lord Shiva, you are a shareholder of the portion of the sacrifice, and you are the giver of the result. The bad priest did not deliver your share, and therefore you destroyed everything, and the sacrifice remains unfinished. Now you can do the needful and take your rightful share. No, he's saying, just take your share. You deserve it. It's yours. And now he's asking for a benediction. When you pray at the end, you ask for the benediction. My dear Lord, by your mercy, performer of the sacrifice, King Daksha may get back his life. Bhaga may get back his eyes. Bhrigu his mustache. And Pusha his teeth. O Lord Shiva, may the demigods and priests whose limbs have been broken by your soldiers recover from the injuries by your grace. O destroyer of the sacrifice, please take your portion of the sacrifice and let the sacrifice be completed by your grace. So now he's in the purport, I think paragraph 3. Is it 1, 2, 3? Yeah. So it is said in Bhagavad Gita, all the demigods are satisfied when one performs yajna, because the demigods expect prasad from yajnas. Yajna must be performed. So Lord Shiva wanted his prasad, and he didn't get it. Those who engage in sense gratificatory materialistic activities must perform yajna, otherwise they will be implicated. Thus Daksha, being the father of mankind, was performing yajna, and Lord Shiva expected his share. But since Shiva was not invited, there was trouble. By the mediation of Lord Brahma, however, everything was settled satisfactorily. So here is the trouble. He didn't get his maha, Prabhupada says. That all the demigods, they expect their maha prasad. This maha prasad is from Vishnu, because he offered it to Vishnu first. So demigods, they all get their maha. Shiva didn't get his maha. So therefore, there was trouble, Prabhupada says. So Prabhupada then goes into all the difficulties of performing sacrifice, and he ends the purport the same way that we heard through many of these purports, through this whole section. How what we must do now in Kali Yuga, under the circumstances in this age, in order to keep the balance of social peace and prosperity, all intelligent men should execute the performance of Sankirtan Yajna by chanting holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is the sacrifice for this age that Prabhupada was emphasizing all throughout the purports. We don't have to, and it's very difficult, showing all the difficulties of performing these Vedic sacrifices, practically impossible. So therefore, we should just chant Hare Krishna and be happy, as Srila Prabhupada says. So we'll stop here. There's a little time for questions, because we had so many verses today. But we got into it anyway, even though we had so many verses. We had a lot of discussion. So anything, last discussion? Yes?
Regarding this anger, we shouldn't harbor anger.
Vishabdev. Second verse.
552.
Vimanyava.
Without anger, and in bracket it says, as we preach, we meet all star people. Still, we shouldn't have anger.
Okay, as we preach, we meet all kinds of people who may make us angry, but still, we should not become angry. This is the symptom of Mahatma.
Yeah.
Mahatmanas. What is that? Yeah, Mahatsevam Dwara Mahur Vimuktes. Mahatsevam. 552. The behavior of Mahatma. So Lord Brahma was indirectly instructing Lord Shiva that this is the behavior of a saintly person. He forgives. So you are a saintly person, of course. You are omniscient. You are this. You should forgive. Sankirtan.
At this very sacrifice for Vishnu, is that all this done as security activity?
Okay. Yes. Okay, his question is, must these Vedic sacrifices be considered fruit of activity? Are they always fruit of activity? Yes? Fourth chapter. Two types of yajna. Okay, so there's a purport. You know the exact verse and purport? You can give us a reference. Fourth chapter, he studied that chapter. It was up on the board. Okay, he's talking about in the Vishnu category of Vedic sacrifice.
In other words, the person thinks what's it for me. He's doing
yes.
The purpose to get something.
Can yes. It be nishkam? Ambarish Maharaj. Yes, Bishop Bihari Prabhu.
What was also the other way?
Fifth canto. Which one?
Bharat.
Yeah. Yes. Ambarish Maharaj also, he performed all the sacrifices, but actually He was into devotional service. So it can be.
Can be done.
Can be done.
And then the result of that, she hasn't been given any adults.
Mahaprasad, you distribute maha.
So
they want their maha.
They don't get it.
They don't get it, watch out. Yes, I mean, devotees are the same, whether they're here or they're in the heavenly planets. They want their maha.
I think the one who does it, he doesn't want anything in India. Maybe maha in the sense of...
Yes. Well, see...
For enjoyment, just for all of it.
No, because, see, Maharaj Ambarish, he was in the position of emperor. So therefore, in that position, you have to do certain things. So he did them, but that was not... He wasn't very... He didn't want anything out of that. It was just as a duty. He was doing it as a duty, and he was doing devotional service to Krishna. That was his heart. That's what his heart was into. Yes?
There's two statements that are quite similar to this discussion. And there's two statements that I believe is probably contradictory and maybe something about.
Okay.
In one place, Prabhupada talks about how there is an invisible connection between the devotees and the
demigods.
And they chain. Yeah, and they help them go back to God.
Oh yeah.
And there's another place where Prabhupada writes that when the devotee starts making progress,
the demigods oppose him.
In the way.
Yeah. So that's in connection with Priyavrat. Priyavrat, I believe. I think so, because putting obstacles, because he wanted to take sannyas, and then now there a big obstacle came. Yeah, Brahma. And also they get... sometimes they're worried the devotees want to take their position. And if a devotee...
Why should they do that? The devotee doesn't want.
Well, the devotee doesn't want, but the demigods are thinking he wants. I mean, just like you may see somebody who's a pure devotee, but if you're not a pure devotee and you look at that person and see him doing something, you may say, oh, he's just doing that because... He wants money or some. He wants position. He wants this. He wants that. But the devotee who's doing it may not want any of those things.
Sometimes they help and sometimes they...
Yeah, sometimes they help and sometimes they don't.
Depending on if they recognize the motivation of the devotee.
Adi Purush.
The verse comes in 11, 10.
Okay.
11:4:10. And there is an interesting statement by Srila Jiva Goswami.
Okay, let's hear Srila Jiva Goswami.
The continuous obstacles presented by demigods form a kind of ladder or stairway upon which the devotee steadily progresses back to the kingdom of God.
Okay, let's say that. That's so wonderful. Okay, this is Srila Jiva Goswami says, the obstacles presented by the demigods form a kind of ladder or stairway upon which the devotee goes steadily progresses back to Godhead. So the obstacles become helpful. We find this in spiritual life, that if you have the right consciousness, whatever obstacle comes, it can actually help you. It can be seen as, oh, this helps me in my spiritual life. So the obstacles of the demigods, so actually they're helping you by giving you obstacles. They think they're giving you obstacles. But actually, the result is that you're making more advancement.
Maybe they think you're doing...
Maybe they think they're helping you by giving you obstacles. Some people think like that.
Yeah.
Yes, let me help this devotee. I will put so many obstacles. Yeah, we just read that. He looks at... Yes, calamities as blessings. Yes. Adi Purusha Prabhu says the process of learning is a series of more and more difficult tasks in order to train the student. More and more difficult challenges. And actually, there's a point in the devotee's life where you get past nishta, which we're all waiting for, you get past anartha nivritti, that the obstacles, Prabhupada says in one purport, they're just energy of the Lord. They're just energy. They're just the Lord's energy. So these obstacles, the Lord turns them, in these impediments, he turns them into help. Bhavas. Emotions. He turns them into help for the devotees, all the obstacles. So there comes a point in our spiritual life where that we can see that happening. Right now, if something happens, we don't appreciate, we get angry, we think, how am I going to get around this? Or sometimes we say, no, it's... After a while,
then we appreciate it. Oh yeah, it succeeds. After failing to overcome the obstacle, okay, anyway, it's Krishna's mercy. But yes, no, but actually it's Krishna's mercy. Okay, yeah. Astrology. Planets are the demigods. Right. Yes. So yeah. So astrologically speaking, then even if you look at it from the level, for the viewpoint of a materialist, things may seem bad. But if you're a devotee and you see that, oh, like you lose your wife, well, he takes sannyas. He might be a sannyasi. Not good for married life. Oh, good for sannyas. Not good for business. Well, can preach. So many of the, not good for enjoyment in this world. So that's very good, helpful for us. You're not going to enjoy much. Which purport?
1919.
Yes, 1919. Tribulations imposed upon the devotee by the Lord cause another spiritual exchange called bhavas, 1919. Okay. So there's many different ways of looking at these things that happen to us. Any other? Yes, Kavi Karnapur.
I have one question.
Mm-hmm. Two. Okay, well, I think we have time for one. It's not.
Is there any explanation why Brahma is so anxious to...
Okay, why is Brahma so anxious to bring this yajna to a proper end? Yes. Okay, because the yajna was for the welfare of the whole universe, and Brahma's in charge, and also Daksha is his son. Your son is killed, and you know, and there's, you know, your two sons are fighting. You want there to be some kind of reconciliation. Yes, Majbihari. What's that?
It's painful to see people at odds with each other.
Yeah, it's painful to see people at odds with each other. Yes. He wants to mediate it. He wants it to become a peaceful settlement. He was asked by the demigods to help. And that's his duty. Brahma's duty is when there's some trouble in the universe, he steps in. He has to step in and rectify it or help.
Why is not just covenant? Because he's teaching we should be...
Why not just...
This is the other question.
What should be the limit of our tolerance? Okay, he's... Okay.
The other side of the question is, should we just tolerate everything for demons to destroy everything?
Okay. That's a good question. I mean, so he says, well, why didn't Brahma just tolerate everything that happened and just let it go? Let it go. He's telling Shiva to be tolerant, so why doesn't Brahma just be tolerant and let the universe go to pieces? Yes. Yeah, he's in charge. He's the manager. So the manager cannot say, okay, I'm just going to tolerate and the whole management can go to hell. He has to actually do something. He has to step in. That's his position, to step in the management of the universe when the demigods can't manage. Yeah.
One's tolerant one forms itself, ourselves, but not others.
Yes, one tolerates one's... Oh yeah, this is actually the proper behavior. If someone insults you, you tolerate. So nobody insulted Brahma, but somebody insulted, there's a problem with his children, the demigods and the sages. So therefore he has to rectify it. Yeah.
We talked about the beauty of the Kshatriyas is that he doesn't run away.
Beauty of the Kshatriyas, he doesn't run away.
He takes responsibility.
He takes responsibility. Right. So In one case, in some, it depends on your position. If it's an offense to you, you tolerate. And if it's something to do with your management or your duty or your devotional service, then you have to do your service. You know, the guru, he has to chastise sometimes. He doesn't tolerate when the disciples do nonsense. He shouldn't anyway, yeah. Yesterday, you made him... Okay. Correction?
I mean, the chapter on 458... of the Brahmins, they say, regarding the storm coming at them.
458. Oh, the storm coming.
Saying,
oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've got this here. Not 458. 458. Oh, 8.
And we were saying that this valley is Prashna Varsha.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a research,
And actually, Varaha is Prachina Barisha.
The Prachina Barisha.
We were saying that.
Yeah.
It looks like my son is not good.
Okay, that's what you saw.
That's what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a research, and actually, Prachina Barisha will be at the Chakshusha.
Chakshusha. Okay, so it's not the same. It's not the same. This was in Swayambhuvamanu.
It's not the same. It won't be married.
Yeah. They have similar names. Okay, so, okay, last comment, if it's very small. Right. So the higher you are, her observation is that then the more tolerant you are. And that's true. The Brahman is the highest, and he's the most tolerant. The Brahman is the emblem of tolerance and forgiveness. So we'll stop here. And tomorrow we'll start the seventh chapter. Okay? All glories to Srila Prabhupada.